I still remember the afternoon and where I was standing when Normie said, "You've just got to start." You know, he said, "There's power in starting." So it was just open the gate and throw the cattle in together and start. And looking back, I didn't have the skills to pull it off at then, and probably still don't now. But that's what makes you learn.
Welcome to the Soars for Life podcast. I'm Soars for Life CEO Ellie Court. If you're a long-time listener to this podcast, you'll be used to our in-depth episodes co-hosted by Grow Love Project's Susie Cable and Soars for Life's James Dyack. We're continuing to make these episodes, but from time to time, we'll be adding shorter interviews with farmers doing interesting things to regenerate soils and landscapes. This is the first of these interviews with actress-turned-farmer Rachel Ward and farm manager Mick Green. Mick and Rachel jointly manage a farm in the Nambucca Valley on the New South Wales mid-north coast. As newbies to regenerative farming, they decided to make the most of Rachel's lifetime of experience with filmmaking to produce a documentary about their journey. That documentary, called Rachel's Farm, is out now on limited release. This is a broad-ranging conversation about getting started in a new approach to farming, working as a team, learning from friends and neighbours, and dealing with pests and extreme weather. Most of all, I enjoyed hearing about Mick and Rachel's incredibly humble and curious mindset, always questioning, never afraid to admit to a mistake and learn from it. I hope you enjoy listening to this conversation. And just a note, you'll hear some references to Normie in this podcast. Normie worked with Mick and Rachel during the early days of their journey and was the ideas man and inspiration behind many of their shifts. Rachel Ward and Mick Green, welcome to the Soars for Life podcast. Thanks so much for coming to talk to me.
Thanks for having us on.
Thrilled that you're asking us. Thrilled that we've got to this level, that we can be on Soars for Life. That was my benchmark. That was what I was listening to when I was starting out and going, will I ever get to that? And here we are.
Well, that is thrilling to hear. Thank you, Rachel, for saying that. Yeah.
Was all the other farmers that I was listening to and thinking, oh, my God, they've been at this for so long. They know so much. They've got such a wealth of experience. Will we ever get there? And, you know, to a point where we're useful, where we've got a bit of experience to impart. You know, we haven't been at it for that long, so just remember that. But I think that's our virtue.
Yeah.
Is that we're still newbies, aren't we, Mick?
Yep. And I think we're making all our mistakes as fast as we can, and we're being honest and sharing them.
Well, that really yes. comes through, I think, in the film is a sense of humility. I mean, given that you are, as you say, Rachel, pretty early on in the journey, it's a fairly vulnerable thing to do, to put yourself out there and say, hey, this is us. This is all the steps we've taken and all the missteps we've taken, and here's how an independent third party has verified our soil health and our landscape health. That's a pretty incredible and vulnerable and humble thing to do. So absolutely, congratulations and thank you for sharing.
Well, it was far worse at the beginning. I remember being on Charlie Arnott, and Charlie, you know, came to talk to me when I'd been, literally Mick and I'd been at it for about 2 weeks. And I saw Charlie at some conference and he said, I want to come and talk. And I said, you'll get about 5 minutes worth. And he said, I don't mind. That's why you're changing is enough for me to hear about.
Yeah, absolutely.
And certainly when I started the film, I didn't want to do me. I didn't want to do our farm. I wanted to go and visit all the other farms. I wanted to put a sort of visual template to Charlie Massey's book, Call of the Reed Warbler. Because when I read that book, I just, every time he spoke about one of those farmers, every time he spoke about that land and over the fence, I said, I want a picture. I want to see it. And so that was very much my motivation to begin with. And then Tina Dalton, who was the producer, went, no, we very much need to watch you and Mick stumbling through the early stages, you know, to see. We don't want any, we're more interested in all the mistakes than we are in somebody, you know, who really knows what they're doing.
We're at a point where there are more and more farmers who are wanting to, they're curious, they're wanting to try something new and different, and they may be where you were a couple of years ago. And I think we need different stories now, and your story is coming at a perfect moment. So, Rachel, I was going to ask you, you know, farming's not what most people will know you for. How did it happen? How did you end up driving tractors and digging through cow paths looking for dung beetles?
I blame it all on Mick Green. He came to me and he said, after we'd been drought for about 4 years. When did that? The drought sort of finished late 2019. Well, after the fires, sort of 2020. Like everybody else, we were hand feeding. We'd got rid of most of our weaners. And I think, you know, Mick was really doing it tough. And I think Mick, you can answer this question, but Mick came to me and said, I don't think we can make this small farming work either financially or ecologically. And I've got another idea. I've been doing some research and I've got something that I think we need to make our land more robust in order to prepare ourselves for increasing climate extremes, events that were predicted. So I was all ears. And really about the same time, I had read a review of Charlie Massey's book. And I went, oh, this is all what Mick's been talking about. I better have a read. And absolutely was so hopeful and excited by that book. Yeah, just sort of went, well, this is absolutely worth a go. So then after that, I was in Mick's hands and basically just did what I was told after that, mostly.
And Mick, Rachel introduces you in the film as the hoon up the street. Have you always wanted to farm in partnership with one of Hollywood's leading actors?
Rachel and Brian are just neighbours, you know. They're part of the community here, so... I guess growing up as that hoon, I didn't really see him as any different than, you know, they were Dad's employer before my employer. But looking at it now, I'm so excited that Rachel's got that skill set and that platform to tell the story that's so worthwhile of telling. You know, it's spreading our story of soil health and everyone trying to do their bit to make things better.
You both in your own ways seem to have an incredible capacity for change. I mean, Mick, you say that every bad thing on the farm comes back to something I've done. That must be a hard thing to reflect on and to admit to yourself, let alone to the whole world.
Yeah, I guess now though, once I've adopted that view, it's so much easier. You just go out and ask, what have I done to cause this problem? And it's easier than being in denial. And yeah, nature's nearly always got it right.
And when you started farming, you pretty much, it sounds like from the film, you picked up where your dad left off, which you describe as a conventional farming approach. So what changed?
Well, for me, it's all those little snippets of information and news reports of you know, climate change. And in the movie, for Rachel, the fires were the catalyst and this driving, you know, the climate crisis. And that's just one thing for change. But we could talk about any number of things, you know, pollution, loss of biodiversity, that, and they're all hand in hand, but all of them, our problem, you know, we've done them. We're only to blame. As a kid living on the farm, we weren't close to the beach, so we weren't surfing. We were down the creek, and we would spend all our afternoons and weekends fishing, and it just seemed to be where little boys would go, play around the creek. I see that as less abundant now than what it was when I was there, whether that's just my memory and yeah, but there's definitely things that I like, the bridge just down the road where I used to walk over to catch the school bus. and there would be mullet underneath that bridge. I don't see mullet there now. I haven't seen them there for years. So, and that's not a big study that I've done. That's just an observation. But I'm aware that, you know.
What about the algae? What about the algae that we see there now? Was that there before?
No, or the salvinia weed? No, there was. Mm-hmm. That's a newer thing.
The other thing that I noticed from the film is you said the shift came often through conversations with mates, and there's Normie, obviously, who seems like he played a really important role. But can you talk a bit more about those conversations?
Well, I guess for the most part, when we go to make a change, we often verbalise it or bounce it off someone first. And I think that's just human nature to, you know, if something's on your mind, you'll throw it out and see what sort of reaction you get. But, yeah, Normie and I often had these in-depth conversations about farming and ecology and the right way. And it was just all little learnings and readings of Alan Savory and Greg Judy, Gabe Brown, all those big hitters. And it all just, it's common sense. It makes so much sense.
I mean, there are so many farmers out there now who have heard about regenerative agriculture. They're curious to learn more. But what we're hearing again and again is the first step's often the hardest, especially when now there's just so much information out there. It can be a bit overwhelming to know where to begin. So how did you both decide where to start on this journey? What were the very first steps you took in this direction?
I was just going along with, I was very much led by Mick. I had no farming experience at all. So it was a baptism of fire just to be a farmer, let alone a regen farmer, which in a way Mick always says is my advantage because I don't have to relearn anything. Mick was always very much about, we just do something very simple to start with, which was breaking up our paddocks. If we don't like it, we can go back. There's nothing, we haven't put any money into this. And I went, yeah, go for it. Let's see how you and Normie, you know, felt it was working before we went any further. So, yeah, we just didn't. We started with with those bloody electric wires that make that wonderful tick, tick, ticking noise.
I still remember the afternoon and where I was standing when Normie said, you've just got to start, you know. He said, there's power in starting. So it was just open the gate and throw the cattle in together and start. And looking back, I didn't have the skills to pull it off at then, and probably still don't now. But that's what makes you learn, is just taking a plunge. And yeah, I probably should have went and done some RCS courses prior, but I've learned some good lessons in the beginning and along. And I'm still learning.
I think what's so great about moving to a different form of agriculture when you know, Mick was probably 40 when he started this, it's out of the norm. You're doing something different. You're working with nature rather than against it for a start.
If something's hard, you're generally fighting nature, and she'll win. Or it's trying to, or it's got more energy than we have.
You say in the film, it's easy to start letting go of some of the things I've learned and start heading in another way. Is there anything you put that down to? Like, most people don't say it's easy to let those things go behind. Most people say, oh, it is. You do have an advantage if you come new to farming.
Yeah, it's just taken a bit of time. I think as my ecological literacy gets better and better, you really see the bigger picture, like looking at as a systems thinker looking at the whole. Yeah, I can use a chemical and solve a little problem here in the stockyards, but when you understand, I'm probably creating 20 more problems or knock-on effects. It gives you a bit more power to go, we've got to limit the use of this or do something different next time to try and not use that.
There's a really powerful moment in the film where you get hit by a pest problem and have to face the difficult choice about whether to reach into the toolkit, as you call it, for the chemical tool. Can you just talk a bit about that decision making?
Yeah, look, making any of those decisions now requires a little bit more thought. Only this morning, I was at a neighbour's place and picked up one of our weaners from his yards, and I just looked. He was running cattle through, and you know, he was drenching, it's just such the go-to tool because it works. You know, I put that on and it gets rid of the flies or the ticks or the internal parasites. But knowing that those things are cascading and compounding, you know, as I put that on, understanding that I could be killing all my earthworms. And once you start understanding how much work an earthworm and a dung beetle can do, it hurts a little bit more to put that, to use that chemical tool.
So tell us a bit about some of the first experiments you decided to introduce at the farm. You talk about the worm juice, the compost, the cattle cafeteria. I love the idea of the cattle cafeteria. And the dung beetles. Tell us a little bit more about how you decided to try those things and how it went.
I did an HM course, and at the HM course, we were encouraged then to meet up every 6 weeks with our group. We had a terrific group, and we had a very experienced HM practitioner who lives up on the ranges above us. Mick was talking about how we were going to feed our cattle because we don't have any perennial grasses in winter, and we were talking about planting rye and what we could do to plant rye without tilling and without putting fertilizer on. And he said, "Why are you bothering doing this planting? Why don't you just feed them with the cattle canteen?" And so now at the moment, we give a bit of copra for protein, and we have a selection of sulfur and salt and a couple of other things that we have out. But the magic ingredient is a tiny bit of urea in the copra, and the urea activates the microbes in the stomach. So it turns the microbes into protein as well.
And have you also done some training like holistic? Rachel mentioned she'd attended a holistic management course. Have you also done training, or are you sort of mostly self-directed learning, reading, that sort of thing, Mick?
Yeah, the latter. I was lucky enough to go and do a two-day course with Joel Salatin up in Byron Bay quite a while back, but I've learned bits and pieces, and I went to like the tail end of Rachel's holistic group.
Mick was pretty abreast of all that stuff right at the beginning. I mean, he underplays it, but he knows it all.
Are there any other resources that you recommend to people?
I think that, well, both Mick and I, you know, I mean, I've never stopped listening to a regen podcast or a holistic management podcast. I mean, at the moment, we're really interested in winter nutrition, obviously. So anything on winter nutrition is something that we're alert to, aren't we, Mick?
Yep. Yeah.
So, you know, we basically focus on our weakest link. And Mick's got, you know, after we had the issue with the buffalo flies, there was no quick fix that we could do other than genetics. And that was the long-term thing. Was really our answer was we kind of had the wrong cattle for our area. And at the moment, really, that's not a quick fix. That's a long-term thing. It gradually changing genetics.
It's, going to take some time, but I realised that a lot of the things that we've been doing in the past conventionally with chemicals and where we buy our seed stock animals from, they've been using the same chemicals. And essentially what that does after years and years of doing it is it takes away that natural selection where animals were resistant to parasites. You know, they had to become resistant. So if they're never exposed to those things, they will never, ever, you can't expect them to come to our farm and be resistant to any of those things. So you've more or less got to either find the right programs that the people that are running those programs and try and hurry your genetics along that path as well. But and that's just one of the ways. You know, there is other things too. You know, we work trying to work on our nutrition to get them in a better shape so they're able to deal with it better. Lots of those little things.
We'll
probably have to dip into our toolkit again, and our conventional side might be using a slasher, or Rachel suggested the other day we might use fire. That they're all tools in the shed.
We're always looking for something which is less impactful, has less cascading effects. And in the end, I mean, it makes absolute sense that we should move away from Angus, because they're bloody Scottish cattle. What are they doing here? You know, of course, they've been genetically modified, but it makes so much sense that we work with cattle who are on the same latitude as us. And that's Zimbabwean cattle and, you know, South African cattle. So we've sort of moved towards the Senepals and the Moshonas, haven't we, Mick?
Yep.
Because they do better on the lignified grass, we don't really have really high protein grass. So they do better on that grass. They're supposedly better with more resistant with the sort of flies that they would have in Africa as well. So it seems a natural thing to sort of start to look in that direction rather than, you know, going to Europe from European cattle, which seem crazy, really, while we're using European cattle. Market-wise, we'll take a hit for that. That's the problem.
Yeah, we're in a commodity world where they want to see big Euro and British bred cattle. But and look, I know there's always... Those guys would argue and say they're nativized, and a lot of them are. They would be pretty well adapted Angus, and a lot of those breeds could be. But more to the story is that a lot of their natural adaption is taken out with the use of chemicals and the use of artificial feeds. If Rachel and I go down the road and buy a bull from a farm that they grow the feed or bring the feed to them, we expect our cows to go out and forage for themselves and eat it and do the whole thing and carve for themselves. And we don't want to do all that work. That's where we think the efficiencies are going to be. As fuel gets more expensive and all those inputs, we can't afford to cart. We want an animal that lives and does here on what we grow without high inputs. And I will never argue with someone who says, "Yeah, but your kilos per day, you gain more, or your conception rates are better." Yes, they're all true. All of those things are true, but there's more to the story. And if I want my kids to be able to farm into the future, I have to listen to that story, because our systems, you know, that's. Those natural systems are what you have to listen to and work in it in that, you know, that realm.
Yeah, and what you're describing, I think, are some of the barriers that are in the way when you're trying to swim against the tide. You know, the whole system is set up to do things one way. We see in the film a really familiar theme throughout of these ups and downs, just as things seem like they're going okay, something happens to throw a spanner in the works. And, you know, getting through the first winter without any winter perennials, going into the red, having to let Normie go, the ideas man. Then rolling into too much feed after the rain, trying to buy cattle when everyone else was, straight into the buffalo fly problem. And then 1 year in, when you just finally, as you say, trickling out of the red, and it starts to rain and it keeps on raining.
Just when you think, oh, I'm getting on top of this, or we're getting on top of this, there's always something that comes.
There's always the next thing you want. There's always something you're working on.
You know, our dung beetle problem is definitely concerning. You know, the way that we've just, they're far and few between, you know, that's definitely been a concern. And the thing is, as Mick always says, we're not an island. You know, we can be doing the right thing on the farm and encouraging it, but, You know, you can't cage a dung beetle in, as I discovered. You know, we don't, unless everybody in the area is starting to think about chemicals, and we're fighting against the wind. Yeah.
Yeah, we're not an island, and our farms are so small. Everyone's using a different chemical, so we haven't even got that advantage of using one chemical at a time. We're using them all, and every time the pests, you know, we kill 95% of the flies, and 5%, that 5% that live, they're the resistant ones, and they're the ones we breed from. So next year, guess what? There's a lot of resistance anyway. So
as you say, you're not an island, and what your neighbours do does matter. What's the community like in the area, and do you talk with your neighbours about what you're doing, and how do they feel about it?
Yeah, well, there's always conversations, and this doco is incredible because people are going to be talking, and I welcome those conversations.
But it's really important to have someone nearby who's farming with the same environment as you are, and weather as you are, soil as you are. Very important, because you can talk to all these other guys, and you know they're all farming. Everybody's farming in different areas and different environments, and it's a vastly different way of farming each time. You know, no one is sharing our issues except for people who are in, you know, the mid North Coast. So you really do need a couple of mentors in your area, and we've had them, and now we're one of them.
Rachel, I mean, you started your journey in a place of real despair, looking at the threat of climate change. And you know, that threat came right to your doorstep with the Black Saturday fires. And you said something similar in the film. You said nothing felt big enough to be able to reckon with climate change, and everything that you might do felt sort of meaningless. I'm interested in how you feel now.
I feel empowered. I feel empowered as somebody who has land. I feel empowered as a filmmaker, and I feel empowered as a consumer. Actually, that's the main thing. I feel that we have the power of our food dollar, and where we choose to spend that and how we choose to spend that is influencing both the way that food is grown, mainly the way that food is grown, but also our food health, of course. You know, I'm listening to all those stories about how we've lost nutrient density in our food, how so much of it is empty. And, you know, this whole thing about our roots growing long to get down and find those nutrients. You know, when you start to get a bit of, you start to do a bit of your biology research, it all starts to just make, it's very simple.
Your film does end in a place of hope, and it seems like you've landed in a place of hope, which is really wonderful to see. And I think it's why so many people are excited by the potential of regenerative approaches to farming. I think it's interesting also to hear you say that nature has her pace and you can't hurry it. And it does seem like this is a tension that a lot of people in this space, a lot of farmers farming with nature, need to balance, you know, that feeling of urgency that we need to change, and we need to change fast, and that same feeling of needing to go with the rhythms of nature, with the cycle of nature, and not being able to hurry nature faster than it wants to go.
Mick, you answered that. He's much more patient than me.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time thinking about time frames and generational time frames, both, you know, the human time frame, and how everything has a certain time frame. Grasses, you know, they're short-lived, and lots of things, and these are some of the complexities in nature. There's short feedback loops and longer ones, and that it's a really, really complex thing. And, you know, just to change the genetics of our cows, you know, you don't see much before 5 to 10 years, you know, minimum five. But things are happening at different paces. As humans, we like to see a change tomorrow, because we've picked up the tool. I've used it on a cow. The ticks are dropping off tomorrow. That's what I like. But I've come to understand that that may not always be a good thing. You know, that's, and a lot of our tools that we've become addicted to and picked up along the way are fast tools. You know, gives us instant relief and satisfaction or gratification or whatever it may be. But yeah, there's always a bigger story and a bigger picture going on, those cascading, compounding, you know, things. And some of the effects of those fast tools mightn't be really seen for a couple of years, or but you've got to be ultra observant to pick them up.
But the paradox is too, of course, once you've got them working, I mean, many farmers in this realm call themselves lazy farmers because yep. they've got the solar working for them and they've got the cattle working for them. I mean, we're all solar now. Mick's turned all of the pumping, all of our pumps, all of our troughs are now run solar. So we've got that working for us. Mick doesn't have to go around and check the water anymore. The cattle do the trampling. Basically, in the end, you know, of course, there's always the yard work and various things you do, you know, and looking at your grasses, measuring your grasses, et cetera, et cetera. But essentially, you're just moving the cattle from one paddock to the next and letting it do the job for you. I mean, it's funny because Mick Senior looks at us and goes, oh, there's so much work in this, because he sees Mick moving the cattle every day. And we look at him and we go, oh my God, he's got to kill the grass, then he's got to plant the grass, then he's got to fertilize the grass, then he's got to irrigate the grass. I mean, that is a lot of work. We don't do any of that.
I think that's a great place to finish. I just have one more question. Mick, I think Rachel is in many ways your apprentice. As she said, at least at the beginning, you were the brains and the brawn of the operation. So how's the apprentice doing now?
She's always astounding me. She's learning lots and lots.
I'm a biggest pain in the ass as I always was. And yet the other day I got on the tractor. What was the first thing I blew, Mick? What was the thing, the stabilizer?
Lost a stabilizer bar out of
the stabilizer. And then I'm chuffing along, some quite rough slashing in an area that we got a lot of tree regrowth in, and something hit the back of the tractor and smashed the window. And I spent all weekend going, oh my God, how am I going to tell Mick that I've smashed the back window as well? But anyway, I think he expects it now. So
your strong point is what we're doing now. You're a brilliant communicator, a fabulous storyteller, and
Without you, we
wouldn't have told this story.
We're a good combination. And we haven't finished. We haven't finished our journey together.
We're still going.
Yeah.
Good on you both. Thank you for sharing your stories. It's been a joy talking with you both.
Thank you very much.
This podcast has been produced by Soils for Life. We'd like to thank Rachel Ward and Mick Green for being part of this episode and sharing their story and their insights. For more information, check out the links in the show notes and make sure to look out for Rachel and Mick's film, out now in limited release. We love to hear from listeners, so please don't hesitate to get in touch on our socials or via info@soilsforlife.org.au. Thanks for listening.